Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, a little bit behind because I've had a very busy schedule this past weekend. I was a scholar in residence in Teaneck and now came back to finish up my lecture series this past Monday and last night and Wednesday. Finally concluded about the Russian pogroms of 1881. Eventually it'll be on the podcast, but it'll probably take a while. Anyway, so to try to get back to my schedule, I looked and I see this week is some big famous names. And the one that caught my attention, zeroed in, was famous Reb Chaim Isaac Grzesinski. You know, let me say this. I've evolved organically into talking about two types of famous Gedolim, I guess, on these midweek podcasts. One is people are famous, but actually very obscure. So then I have to tell you, who they were. And then there are other people that are very famous that even you've heard of, and you can easily research. And then I don't have to tell you about their biography so much, but rather share with you an angle that I have perhaps on that person. So, Reb Chaim Isaac Grzesinski probably fall in the second category, because who hasn't heard of him? The famous Gadol who died in 1940. I think he was born in 1860, so he lived 80 years. It's not that long, nevertheless. And who hasn't heard about him if you have anything to do with yeshivas or things of that nature anyway? But I want to, therefore, not concentrate so much on his biography, interesting as that is. He had a rather tragic life, actually. Tragic life. But rather on a certain historical angle. And I'll tell you what I mean. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, those living on the moon, Chaim Isaac Grzesinski was this big rabbi who lived in the late 1800s and early 1900s up to 1940. And he was considered the Gadol HaDor by the non-Hasidic world. Okay? And after the First World War, he was the man. And even prior to that, he had a great deal of influence. But he didn't have a job description, and that's what is fascinating to me. So let me speak in straightforward terms. It's interesting that the modern era, which is the last 250 years, which has seen the breakdown of the old traditions in many ways, the autonomous coercive communities, the cultural insularity, all that sort of thing, in what we call modern era, modern times, was sort of countered in the from world by the emergence of, shall we say, authority figures. The whole Hasidus is based on that, right? Being a chassid means you got a rebbe. Rebbe means you do Simon Says. Whatever he tells you to do, you do. And that's a modern thing. Never existed before the modern period. The Baal Shem Tov was in the 1700s. Everybody knows. That's just a historic fact. So the emergence of an office or concept of a rebbe is new in Jewish history, and it's clearly counter-modern, meaning the modern movement is all of modern Western civilization is chipping away at authority. So here they're evolved in Europe. A whole huge movement, fastest growing Judaism today, in which you do the opposite. You kind of transfer all your autonomy to that person's authority. But now I'm going to talk about the non-Hasidim. And they never developed the office of a Rebbe, as you know. On the other hand, there did emerge, in a much more unstructured way, the notion of a top figure, a supreme figure, within that culture, sort of. It's not like a Rebbe, but sort of. And I'm thinking out loud, because that's all I ever do here, sitting in my room and rambling, that you can draw a line, but it no longer exists today. I think Chaim Meiser, maybe after Moshe Feinstein, was the last, at least as far as I can tell. And so you go like this, the Vilna Gaon, Chaim Belozhiner, Ravitza Belozhiner, Ravitza Gaon Inspector, Chaim Meiser, in America, Moshe Feinstein, and that's it. So what did I do? Six or seven names? Now, what does all that have in common? these are people who, totally regardless of their office, their formal position, or lack thereof, achieved a kind of authority status in the non-Hasidic world, which is not structured in such a way to have a Rebbe, and nevertheless had, you know, some kind of a unique authority. I left out the Chazon Ish, by the way. Attained a kind of charismatic authority, which is kind of interesting. And you don't necessarily see this in old Jewish history. Let me tell you what I mean. If you go back in the 18th century, you know, a lot of big rabbis running around that time. You have Yonasan Apshitz, or Nodav Yehuda, and the Shagasari, like I mentioned earlier. But none of them you would say, oh, everybody listens to what this one said. Each one had a following or not a following, and the Hamunam didn't know much of the difference between one and the other. How would they? And it's only we, in retrospect, we look back at their Sfarim and their writings, and our students, they say, oh, this is a famous person. Same thing in the 1600s, the 1500s. The Jewish history of rabbinic world scholarship, Torah scholarship, is, you know, when you have famous people who became famous mostly for what they wrote, or perhaps who they taught, or something like that. But sometimes you have, especially as they say, ever since the Vilna Gaon, people with a kind of a unique charisma that transcends their local environment. So the Vilna Gaon didn't become a big deal in Vilna, only became a big deal throughout Lithuanian Jewry, which is a large category of Eastern European non-Hasidic Jewry. As a matter of fact, on the contrary, the Vilna Gaon, when he lived, and he died in 1797, had no position whatsoever. He wasn't the rabbi of the city. He didn't have a yeshiva. He had a little shtiebel, they call it klois, and, you know, a couple of close disciples, and thus he does. And somehow or other, the reputation permeated outwards, and during his lifetime, especially the second half of his lifetime, he had a tremendous hashpah and authority on people, you know, even today, to Vilna Gaon, oh my goodness. And so it therefore was not dependent on what he wrote, and not dependent on any institution that he headed, and not dependent on him going in politics and making speeches and all that kind of thing, because he did none of those. But rather, it's like literally the Greek word charisma. There's something in some way got out there, and he had it. It. When the Vilna Gaon died, so it took a while, and if you know your history well, Rav Chaim Voloshin kind of obtained this authority. I'm talking about Rav Chaim Voloshin, who was a rabbi of the town of Voloshin, big deal, it's a small town, who set up the famous yeshiva. That was a big deal. That became the basic yeshiva of the modern times. But that was not really the source of his authority. On the contrary, because he had the authority, therefore the yeshiva was able to flourish. So here you have somebody who had no official position outside being a rabbi of a small town, and eventually head of an important school. But nevertheless, if you know anything, not many people know this, by the way, of the first two decades of the 19th century, time of Napoleonic Wars, all the rest of it, he was the guy. And all the other rabbonim and rich balabatim and influential people in Lithuania and White Russia and such places used to go and consult with him, meaning his opinion was the one that he had a charismatic authority. Not exactly the same way the Vilna Gaon did, of course, but nevertheless, it was real, okay? So in places like Minsk and Vilna and, you know, all the places in Belarus and the Lithuanian Latvia, as we would call it today. When he died, this mantle was inherited by his son, Ritzo Voloshiner. I spoke about him in a podcast a month or two ago, who really seems to have been a shy and retiring type of fellow. In spite of what I just said, he definitely exercised that charismatic authority during his time. But since he lived under repressive czarist regimes, he had to kind of hide it. But if you take the trouble to study the accounts and all of that time, you see that he was the one that they all looked to and they all followed and, you know, had a big opinion about. Am I speaking specifically in the area of halacha? Yes, but I'm really speaking much wider than that. You know, to be the Gadol Hador in the sense that, you know, he has sort of like the most important opinion, the final opinion, even though there were other big rabbis at that time as well. Plenty. When Ritzo Voloshiner died, which was like in the 1850s, so this role came to be filled within a decade or so by Rabbi Yitzchak Lehman Spector, who was, of course, the rabbi of the city, the rabbi of Kovno, and didn't have a yeshiva, but the authority that permeated throughout Lithuania, Latvia, Belarus, and those places, and eventually outside of there, was kind of independent of his position as the rabbi of a particular town in Lithuania, but it was due to his charismatic, draw. I spoke about this already. People today are still trying to figure out, like, you know, what did he do that he had such a hold on everybody? But he certainly did. And is this interesting? As he was the final address. When he died, which was in 1896, so it took a while, and no particular person that I know of kind of assumed that role. But eventually, Chaim Isaac Grzynski did. Not right away, but I would say after the First World War. So in the last 20 years of his life, in the 1920s and 30s, he was the guy. And all throughout the non-Hasidic world, if Rav Chaim Isaac said something, that's it. And his opinion really counted. And once again, you have the interesting phenomenon of somebody who had no official role. He wasn't a rav of a town, contrary to what people think. He didn't have a yeshiva, no specific yeshiva. He did for a while have, in the younger years, what they call a kibbutz. The kibbutz is a term that the Zionists appropriated for the agricultural settlements in Israel. I know that. I'm not stupid. But a kibbutz originally was a yeshiva term for a group of superior guys to hang around, be like what we call today a chabura. And so he had a kibbutz in Vilna, in which he would give shiurim and hakken learning, really, with very good guys. You know, it was like one of them off the top of my head, Relazer Silver, from that kibbutz, for example, but many others, and Shmuel Hillman, whatever. And, you know, so he had his group, but he wasn't really a Rosh Hashiva in the classic sense, you know, like a Baruch Be'er or Shimon Shkup or people like that. So he didn't have any specific position, but nevertheless, again, by the First World War, certainly the aftermath of the First World War, he had attained, one way or another, this powerful charisma. And, you know, and his word really counted. He had almost like the final word. And if he gave you a haskama, that's it. And if he dissed a book, then it's hard to get out of that. And it's just very interesting to me because, once again, how did this charisma develop? And so he was, if I can use the term, the Rebbe of the non-Hasidic world, which is just a very interesting position. Again, after the First World War, I'm not only talking about Lithuania, all the rabbis in Germany were machnia to him, and just about all the rabbis in America, and other places as well. Even though he's just some rabbi in a town, Vilna, which was in the Republic of Poland in 1920s, 30s, like, why should it matter? But it did matter. It did matter. There was a whole delegations of German rabbis used to come like every summer to talk to him and get his opinions on things. I'll give you one example of many, many. And that is the Hildesheimer Seminary. This week, I think, is also the Yard Center of Israel Hildesheimer, but I can only do one at a time. And Rabbi Hildesheimer set up to dumb it down for you. The first YU, it wasn't YU, but it's something like that, in which he had in Germany from 1873 on a seminary in which in the morning the boys learned Gemara and all that sort of thing, plus some extra subjects like Jewish history and, you know, whatever, things along those lines. And in the afternoon you go to college and eventually get your PhD. And it was pretty successful in the sense that they turned out bunch of rabbanim who were from and were able to communicate with their communities in Western Europe, in Germany, the West, and all that, because they had PhDs there for their modern men, and that helped them keep the Balabatim from, no question about it. But it was never sort of, the model was never accepted 100% in Eastern Europe, because they didn't like the Limud Chol aspect, all the rest. They just went old-fashioned yeshiva, gemar, gemar, gemar. And Rabbi Hildesheimer died in 1900, 1899. And he had successors. But by the time you get to the Hitler era, 1933, so it became very quickly apparent that there's no future for Judaism and Jewish institutions in Europe. So what's going to happen in Germany, I mean? I'm talking about the 1930s. And so what's going to happen to the Hildesheimer Seminary? They're not going to go for very long under the Hitler regime. And so, on the other hand, it's a unique institution. It is a very firm place, which is turning out people to have Torah and Derech Eretz. It's literally Torah and a PhD. So there were various proposals about transferring it, moving to other places. And this is well known, what I'm saying. And in 1934, which is a year afterwards, the city of Tel Aviv offered him a sweetheart deal, baby. They wanted to have what you call a modern Orthodox. Nice. I'm using the word modern Orthodox. Very firm, modern Orthodox institution in Israel. They didn't, already in the 1930s, they didn't like the fact that everything is black hatter and black coat. And why can't you have a modern cultured Orthodoxy? And the city of Tel Aviv offered them a big piece of land and maybe free buildings and stuff like that to transfer the place to Palestine, which would be great. And instead of Tel Aviv University, you have the Hillsheimer Seminary, something like that. As you know, eventually they came up 20 years later with Bar Ilan, although that's a different sort of thing. But nevertheless, the notion that you want from people to have a kosher option in terms of their higher education, they thought it was a good idea. And the board of directors of the Hillsheimer Seminary, which was the son of Rabbi Hillsheimer and others, they wanted to take the deal, but Rabbi Chaim Eisner nixed it. He said Israel should only be pure, Israel should only have what we call black hat yeshivas and nothing other, totally Haredi. And because he said it, they listened. In other words, they committed suicide. Because if they didn't take the Tel Aviv deal, then the seminary was doomed. But by 1934, the power of Chaim Eisner was such that if he said it's called Vedas Torah, and you have to give him credit, they were from guys, and they said, okay, then we will self-destruct. And that's what happened. So I'm trying to tell you, that's what you call authority. Now, they were Germans. They didn't have to listen to him, but they did. So that's what I mean when I say you have transnational authority. When Reb Chaim Eisner died, the best I can see is, although not exactly in the same way, but this was picked up by the Chazon Ish. So after the death of Reb Chaim Eisner in 1940, by the time you get to the late 40s, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, it's more an Israeli phenomenon than elsewhere, the Chazon Ish emerged as the charismatic authority, the way Reb Chaim Eisner did. And by the way, the Chazon Ish was sort of like a disciple and a very close inner friend, younger, of course, with the Chazon Ish. I'm sorry, with Reb Chaim Eisner, you know what I'm saying? And as we all know, the Chazon Ish had a gigantic influence on the formation of the from community, Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael. So, once again, what was his job? The Chazon Ish wasn't a rabbi of a town. He didn't have a shul. He didn't have a yeshiva. He sort of transcended all that. The same way Reb Chaim Eisner did. He didn't have a yeshiva. He was out of all the yeshivas in a certain way. So, to me, it's just a very interesting phenomenon that you have this idea of Godel. In the USA, you and I know, well, I don't know how young you are, but if you're my age or more or less, this is a picture of Moshe Feinstein. And so he had this kind of authority that I just described. If he said it's okay, it's okay. If he said it's not okay, then it's really a problem. And it wasn't a function of the fact that Moshe Feinstein was the Rosh Hashiva and MTJ. There weren't too many guys over there. But it transcended it, okay? Now, in his case, due to the published, scholarship. But even without that, some people have it. And again, this applies to the non-Hasidic world. Ever since the 80s, when Reb Moshe Feinstein passed away, to the best of my ability, and all I ever tell you is what I think, I don't see any gadol like that. There's nobody who the public, just of its own, wants to follow and give that kind of authority. There are a lot of rabbis out there who would like to have that authority, and the Haredi newspapers and magazines are always trying to foist people out there and say, this is the gadol, this is this person and that person, but that's not what I'm talking about. You know, the Vilna Gaon did not appear on the cover of Mishpacha magazine. You know, Chaim Eisner wasn't put out there by, the Yated Neman or something like that. These people are really there or they're not. In Israel, you know, it's a little bit different, but it's more complicated because since Israel has a yeshiva world of its own, it's kind of formalized this process of declaring somebody a gadol. That ain't the same thing. So Reb Yoshev, I think, just had it automatically. But there are other people out there that push that they'll say, this person is now the gadol hador. And then you'll say, I never heard of him until a little while ago. Oh, you never heard of him, but he's the gadol hador. It doesn't work in the same way, at least not to my mind. The natural charisma is the impressive part. The non-natural is not so. The manufactured or the insisted upon is a different story, as far as I can see it. Now, Chaim Leiser had, as I say, a very complicated life, and I don't have time to go through all of this, but I would simply say that he lived all his life in Vilna. He was from the elite group, but in his time, when he was coming up, he's born in 1860, so when he was by the 1880s and all that, 1890s, when he was a young man, he was a genius, no question about it, and super genius in learning, and he was in a situation where Vilna did not have an official rabbi. Well, they did. What do I mean when I say this? The Tsarist Russia. I must have mentioned it before. The Tsars of Russia were such jerks that they administratively tried to force the Jews to become Russians. And one of the projects, going back to the Emperor Nicholas I, was to insist that the only people who can serve as Rabbonim are people who can speak Russian and have a Russian education, which, of course, none of the rabbis had. I mean, in Russia, when I say Russia, I'm talking about Lithuania, Latvia, and Belarus, and Ukraine. The Rabbonim over there didn't even speak anything but Yiddish. Chaim Leiser, for example, all his life, basically only spoke Yiddish. Now, the guy was a genius. He could have learned 10 languages if he wished to. Right? You know, if he could figure all the other stuff out, he could pick up the languages. See, he didn't want to. You know what I'm saying? He didn't want to, as a demonstrative act. If he would say, I picked up Russian on the side, and there were some Gedolim that did, but he didn't, and they picked up Russian on the side, that would send out a message to all the yeshiva guys that Limudi Chol is okay. You should pick up the language in the Medina and then read all the secular books, all the rest of it. He did not want that. And so, if you can't speak Russian, you can't become a Rav of a town. All the Rabbanim were big people and they didn't speak Russian. And so what you ended up was that the Gedolim went back down and the Russian government went back down. And so you had a dual track system in which the government had what they call Rav Mitam. The government, the Jewish community, if they wanted somebody to be a rabbi in Russia, the Russian Empire, the keeping of the official records of who's married, who's divorced, who's born, who's dead, were left in the hands of the clergy. So your tax status, you know what I mean? Your legal status is depending on what the clergy person puts in the official books, what's called the metric books. And if you cheat on those books, you can get in big trouble. And so they needed a rabbi. And so since the Russian government insisted that someone with a Russian education, what the firm ended up doing was saying, okay, we will choose somebody who has a Russian education, but the Iker thing is he should make no pretensions whatsoever to be a Rav. So you have a Rav, but he's not a Rav. So in all these towns, Vilna is a very good example. You would get somebody who was totally not from, and they make him the rabbi. Or a pharmacist, and make him rabbi. Or a dentist, or you know, somebody like that. And what can a guy who's a dentist who can barely read Hebrew doing to be the rabbi? That's the point. Then all the Jews in the town know this guy's a phony. They were only putting him up to satisfy the stupid government regulations. And the real Rav is this other guy who lives a few blocks away, who's an old school Rav. It's Rabbi Zichron Inspector, it's Rabbi Chaim Meiser, it's Rabbi Saul Cohen, you know, the David Carliner. No, it's the real rabbi. And so you had what they call a Kazonia Ravin, the government rabbi, who was just a public official, who was deliberately a non-impressive figure. And then you have the other guy who's the rabbi of the town, really, but he was not paid on the books by the Kehillah as the Rav, because the dentist is the Rav. Rather, he was given some other job, you know, like we'd say today, works for the Vada Kashrus or for the Mikvah or something like that, and that's how they paid him off the books. So, I'm not off the books, but, you know, on the books, but off the real record. Now, why am I mentioning this? Here you have the city of Vilna, a very, very large and important city by the standards of Lithuania, which had a Jewish population explosion. Because I remember at the time of Vilna Gaon was like 2,500. And by the First World War, it was like 60, 70,000 or maybe more. That's huge. So, you know, it expanded tremendously in the 19th century. Now, in Vilna, you had two problems. On the one hand, you have a Rav Mitam. The government insisted on putting some jerk in there. Should be officially the rabbi. Number two, you had a self-denying ordinance on the part of the Rabbanim. Because Vilna was a place where in the 1700s, the time of Vilna Gaon, There was a tremendous, ugly fight over who should be the rabbi there. It's called the Shmuel Ben Avigdor story. And they appointed a rabbi, and one faction liked him, the other faction didn't like him, and they took him to the Polish courts, and the Vilna Gaon ended up going to jail. It was a really messy kind of business. So much so that it's very famous that after this controversial rabbi died in the late 1700s, they sort of came to a quiet consensus that they're not going to elect anybody to be the Av Beis and the official rabbi of Vilna. They can just get along with a group of Dayanim. And that's what they did. They would have a Beis Din, meaning a group of Dayanim, 3, 4, 5 guys. One guy specializes in Gittin, one guy takes care of the Kashrus, one guy takes care, I don't know, your mikvah, things like that, you know, that way, through a specialty. It works. And all throughout the 19th century, 1810s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that's how they kind of operated. So there were famous rabbanim in Vilna, but there was no rabbi of Vilna. And this became like an accepted tradition. What's it called? Binyan Shlomo was there. You know, they were famous, great scholars, very great scholars in Vilna, but there was nobody who's, like I say, the Rav of Vilna. So Rizal Kohanim was the Rav of Kovna. There was no Rav in Vilna. There was a rabbi, though. There was a dentist or a florist or something like that, but that was the official guide. Now, in the case of Chaim Meiser, there was no question by the time he came up and was already in his 20s and 30s, he was a genius and he had a charisma and he was seen as a very smart individual and all the rest of it. And it was already offered to him at this very young age. He could be the Rav of the Frum. And because of his respect for tradition, modest nature, and all that, he said, no, I'll just be one of the Dayanim. And that's how it functioned. On the other hand, they were really ticked off by the late 19th century with all these dentists and florists and, you know, shoemakers being rabbis officially. And it was a big pressure within the rabbinic world to figure some way out in which the real Rabbanim could get recognized by the government as the official Rabbanim. They never quite worked that out. There were conferences about this among the rabbis, among the government, in the first decade of the 20th century. It's a very complicated story. Now's not time to go into it. But never happened. On the other hand, when the dentist or the shoe salesman died in the early 1900s, so there was a Frum guy, I think his name was Yitzhak Rubinstein, who was in Slobodka, but somehow or other he also got a law degree. I forget how he did that. how he managed to combine that Slobodka with a degree from Moscow University beats me. But Chaim Meiser and the others said, so let's put it this way, he was a Frum guy, but somehow or other he cheated and had a college education. But he had smicha, it was a real rabbi. And he got elected, they put him in, and therefore Vilna now had an official rabbi, who was this Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein, who was a Talmud Chacham. Of course, he's not in the same universe of Chaim Meiser. You could be a Talmud Chacham, but that doesn't mean you're in the same, not only league, but same universe and learning of Chaim Meiser. And he was a nice guy, and he made speeches and all that sort of thing, and they felt better because at least the Rav Mitam is a Shomer Shabbos. At least the Rav Mitam, like I say, is not a dentist, not a janitor, you know. And he was respecting of Chaim Meiser, of course, and everything was going good according to that. And meanwhile, Chaim Meiser just was like one of the Dayanim. But really, you could tell that, you know, he's the one that has the heavy weight. The others kind of respect him and listen to him. And it was in this capacity that people thought of Chaim Meiser as the rabbi of Vilna, because kind of de facto in a certain way, behind the scenes and all that, he kind of was. He wasn't. But, and I would say that during these years, when he was in his 30s and 40s, a young man, in the 1890s, in the 1910s, he became very active in Jewish politics behind the scenes. So he clearly was one of these people that liked to work behind the scenes. This is the tradition of Rishol Salanter and other people, Yitzhak Al-Khanan, that they try to frustrate government gezeiras and try to deal with political issues affecting the Jews of Russia and Lithuania, but not out public. They didn't feel comfortable doing it. They liked to work with lobbyists behind the scenes. And Chaim Meiser was definitely from that group. As a matter of fact, it was in the first decade of the 20th century that he helped make the Agudas Yisrael. It's a long story, like I say. I only have a few minutes left, so I'll just leave it at that. The Agudas Yisrael had its convention in 1912, and he was very behind the scenes involved in all that. Then came the First World War. But remember, had he wanted to learn Russian, he could have. And if he would have learned Russian and passed a test or two, which for a genius like him was hard, he could have gotten the job as official rabbi of the city. You know, he could have gotten the job of the dentist. But that's not what he wanted to do. They were already not comfortable with that. So then came the First World War. The Russian government was beyond anal in the First World War. And they used to have hostage taking and things like this. Imagine that on their own people. That's the Russian mentality. And so the Tsarist government. And they shot and killed and raped their own people. You know, lots of Jews had a terrible time in Russia from the Russians in the First World War. I just did a series on this about a month ago, I guess. 5 weeks ago in Baltimore. And in Shomrei Emuna. And again, eventually it'll be online somewhere. I got it on the YouTube already. Anyway, the Russian government did it. So Chaim Weizer was on a hit list. People to be arrested. And, you know, in Russia, they arrest you, they shoot you, and then you have a trial. And so he kind of fled the city. And he spent the years of World War One outside of Vilna. Of course. What they did was the rabbis like him ran away to Minsk. They moved from... I know you don't know the map, so there's no use in me telling you this. But I'll just tell you, the Germans are in the west of Russia. And therefore, the farther east you go, the farther away from the battle lines. Lithuania was on the front line. And so a lot of these yeshivas and rabbis ran away east, to first to Belarus. And then when the war caught up with them there, they ran farther east to the Ukraine. That's what Chaim Weizer did. And he spent those war years running around in these war zones of Russia or behind the front, being active, helping, you know, refugees and trying to organize Jewish life. You know, there was a Russian Revolution in 1917. For a while, they thought it would be a democracy in Russia. And therefore, the Agudah wanted to set up a political party. It's a long story, like I say, too far to go into. By the time the war is over, and he returned to Vilna, so this Rabbi Rubinstein, who had been the official chief rabbi, really stepped up to the plate. And he saved the Jews of Vilna several times from the Russian army and later from the German army that took over and occupied him. He did a lot of chesed for a lot of people and saved a lot of individuals in tough situations. And his wife was amazing, and she set up soup kitchens, and she was a famous Jewish woman of yesteryear. Many people don't know about her. That'd be Esther Rubinstein. And that's a whole... You could do a whole podcast just on her. And they were very, very popular. And Reb Chaim Weizer came back like 1920 or something like that from after the First World War. And the international politics is such that the city of Vilna and its district was seized by Poland from Lithuania, because these are two new countries that started after the First World War, and they had a continuous war for 20 years. And therefore, Vilna was part of the Republic of Poland. And later in the 20s, the Polish government passed a law in which they said there was going to be, for the first time ever in Jewish history, actual democratic elections for a position of rabbi. What do I mean? Throughout Jewish history, you had rabbanim of kehillahs who were elected, but elected by a tiny few. You know, by a board of directors, by the rich, by those who pay a lot of taxes. There's a whole kind of system. We Jews have had a democratic system for thousands of years, but it's an extremely radically restricted franchise. Very few people actually did the voting. Now it's the 20th century, and the new Poland wanted to democratize that for a whole bunch of reasons. And so you have a very interesting situation, which I don't think you usually have in Jewish history. Many people don't know about this. In Poland in the 1920s and 30s, you mamish had democratic elections for a position, which is a government official position of chief rabbi of a town or something like that. Look, take America, for example. No rabbi is democratically elected over here, except in the sense of a synagogue. Rabbis in America are elected in synagogues democratically, you know, by the members of the shul. But you don't have such a thing as somebody's a rav of a town or whatever, a larger area, and is actually democratically elected. Take, for example, the state of Israel today. Is there a Rav Rashi in Tel Aviv? Yeah. Is there a Rav Rashi in Yerushalayim, and Haifa, and all the other places there are? Who votes for him? Not the people of the city. They have some convoluted system in which they, once again, they have, you know, the machers put these people in. You understand? It's not, it would be a very interesting phenomenon in America, and I think it would be better. Let's say, for example, you have a Beis Din in Baltimore, a Beis Din in Lakewood, a Beis Din in New York. Suppose the Dayanim and the Beis Din were actually elected in a formal democratic election. So that all the people of this town, or at least all the frum people, somehow or other figured a way vote for these people. You'd have a very, very interesting situation. I think you'd have a sounder Beis Din system, in my opinion. So in the 1920s, you had this very unusual business in which, thanks to the Polish law, now the Jews of Vilna themselves are going to elect who should be the chief rabbi. And by that time, it's going to be a position with power. And so Rav Chaim Meiser, who was in his late 60s, thought, now he's going to do it. But by that time, Rav Chaim Meiser had already started the Aguda. The Aguda was not the Mizrahi. The Aguda and Mizrahi were bitter enemies in the 1920s and 30s in Poland. It's a sad story. And there were many people in the Mizrahi movement, particularly, who didn't like this and wanted the two sides, to kind of merge together. And Rav Chaim Meiser and others did conduct continuous negotiations throughout the 1920s and 30s if there's some way the Aguda Mizrahi can jump into one organization. But it never happened. You understand? I mean, just to give off the top of my head, one of Rav Chaim Meiser's students from that kibbutz had been Rav Amiel, Rav Moshe Amiel, who became a big person in the Mizrahi movement. He was the rabbi in Antwerp and later in Tel Aviv. Maybe you've seen his very famous Lamedisha Sefer, Hamidus L'Cheker Halacha. And he was a close Talmud of Chaim Meiser, but in terms of politics, he was in the Mizrahi. And he was always trying to make negotiations. Isn't there some way that the two firms should come together? It would be a good thing. I think everybody would agree if you could come up with a basis of agreement, but of course they couldn't. That's what happened. It never happened. So the result is that questions of Zionism or anti-Zionism were a big selah hamachlokas. And make a long story short, the Mizrahi and the Zionists in general, who represent a lot of people, put up Rabbi Rubinstein to be the candidate for chief rabbi of the city. They should be democratically elected. Remember, it's the first time in democratic elections. The Aguda types put up Rav Chaim Meiser. They were outraged that somebody even has the chutzpah to run against Rav Chaim Meiser. I get that. But the fact is he lost. Meaning, they had a campaign. Believe it or not, who was the campaign manager in this democratic election? The Chofetz Chaim, who was like 90. He came to Vilna. He was outraged also. And people would dare to run against Rav Chaim Meiser. So here you have a very fascinating story of a clash between the new and the old. The old is a culture of deference. How dare you even hint to contradict anything a Gadol says. And you have the new, which is, he's elected by the public. The public has the right in secret elections to express their opinion. And Rav Chaim Meiser are lost. And I can tell you, that was considered such a terrible thing by the Aguda types and by the yeshiva world, and such a scandal that there was very, very bitter feelings by the losers. And, I mean, they were even thinking of setting a separate kehillah up, which is something you didn't do in Eastern Europe. And what's really interesting to me is that even the winners, the Zionists and Mizrahi, said, you know, the feelings are too bitter. And so what they, you know, what shall I say, unofficially said was, listen, we're not challenging Rav Chaim Meiser, the biggest Talmid Chacham around in the Gadol HaDor and all the rest of it. And so let's work this out. The chief rabbi won't really interfere with Rav Chaim Meiser, Rabbi Rubinstein, you know. He'll just be the official rabbi, not exactly a Rav Mitam, but, you know, something like that. And no one will interfere in what the Beis Din does and what Rav Chaim Meiser does. They kind of worked out a modus vivendi. So unofficially, he was the chief rabbi. And since by that time, you're talking about the late 20s, he was like, I won't say the god of the yeshiva world because that's not a nice word, but you know, he was the super figure of the yeshiva world. So I guess he was satisfied. I've gone too long already. I just wanted, as I say, to bring out a few aspects. There are 1,000 other things you could say about Rav Chaim Meiser Grudzinski, but I just wanted to put a little bit of it in historical context. When he died, the Jews of Eastern Europe died because he died in 1940, and then they were all killed out by Hitler, all of them, as we all know, unfortunately. 1 year after the death of Rav Chaim Meiser, Hitler came in, and the Einsatzgruppen shot 1.5 million Jews in Eastern Europe. So think about what I just said. This is before the concentration camps were set up. This is before the gas chambers were invented. They just shot all the Jews in Lithuania and Latvia and Belarus and all these places. Very few survivors, as you know very well. My father was one of the very few survivors, but very few survivors. And so the whole world of Chaimers has simply ceased to exist. You know, so you can't say who's the Gadol HaDor in Eastern Europe after him. After that, like as he had the Chazanish, he had Moshe Feinstein, maybe one or two other figures that I'm not thinking about. I guess in the 50s, Reverend Cutler was sort of like that, sort of. But nobody quite with that grand grasp, you know, with that grand charisma. And so one of the big problems we have today, to my mind, is we don't have any Gadol like that. We don't have any big Gadolim. You have a lot of little ones. And, you know, you have Rosh Hashibah, all the rest of it. There's no charismatic figure that everybody says, this is the person who counts. And I think we are all hurt by that, lacking by that. And the younger generation doesn't have a person that they can, you know, fix their charismatic connections with. It's a big subject that I just mentioned. But I've already gone for much longer than I expected. That's probably what happens to me lately. And so with that, I'll say Tisha B'Av's around the corner and you should have an easy fast, a thoughtful fast. And if I have any time tomorrow, we'll either talk about the Parsha or about Tisha B'Av or something like that. But for now, goodbye.